This is Cradle My Heart Radio with your host, Kim Cotola. Cradle My Heart Radio, preventing abortion and helping those it hurts.
This is where the healing begins. Oh, this is where the healing starts. When you come to where you're broken within, the light meets the dark. The light meets the dark.
And now, Kim Cotola and Cradle My Heart Radio.
Thank you so much for joining us for Cradle My Heart Radio, where, yes, our mission is preventing abortion and helping those it hurts. And many of you are familiar with my story of choosing abortion at the age of 23 to what I thought was protect my budding career. That's the case with most abortions. It's not primarily a teen problem. It's primarily a problem for young adults who are in the launch phase. And whether it's education or a job or a relationship, often the decision for abortion is short-term problem solving for what seems to be a life-threatening condition. This change from not being a mother to being a mother seems to threaten our future and hence our lives. And so when I was in that phase in my young 20s, I was not thinking about the legality of this problem solving. I was not in any way engaged with it. And I think that remains the case, even as many of us get deeply involved in pro-life apologetics, in standing for the cause of life. We don't really have a leg to stand on when it comes to understanding the legal basis for the Roe versus Wade decision by the U.S. Supreme Court, nor are we confident in using that information to win hearts and minds. But thank goodness tonight our guest, Professor Robert George of Princeton University, is all of that and more. And it's just a pleasure to welcome you to Cradle My Heart Radio.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Kim. I'm happy to be part of your wonderful effort to inform the public, and especially women, especially those who are contemplating abortion or under pressures to have abortion, helping them to understand what this is really about and the importance of the sanctity of human life and the need to understand the supreme value of the relationship between mother and child, and not to pit the mother against the child or the child against the mother, but to love them both.
Amen. And I want to begin by giving you a chance to talk about your becoming active on the issue of pro-life, your decision to write about this, to speak about it, to become a voice. Because as the McCormick Professor of Jurisprudence at Princeton University, you're uniquely positioned not only to teach us about, you know, the law and what we need to know about it at the individual level, but I don't think that you can be easily dismissed as an ideologue. And this is one of the big problems so many of us run into. We know in our hearts abortion is wrong. Maybe we're armed with the facts about science and philosophy, and someone brings out a case about the law, and now we don't really know where to go with it. And so tell us how you became active on this issue, maybe giving us some of your background and other qualifications as you answer.
Well, my story when it comes to pro-life activism goes back a long way. I'm the eldest of five children, five brothers, all boys. And I don't remember whether it was brother number three or brother number four or brother number five, but I was a little boy, and my mom was expecting a new baby, and at one point she asked me to hold my hand up to her tummy because she felt the baby kicking. She didn't tell me what I was going to feel, but she asked me to hold my hand up to her tummy. So I did that, and I felt the little kick, and it was like magic. It made it so vividly true for me. It made me so aware that was a little baby, a little brother or sister, turned out to be yet another brother, who was right in there inside mom, and would soon be out here in the world with the rest of us. And of course, I was very, very excited about that, and it was clear as it can be. Any child would understand this, that there's a little baby in there. It's not a rock or a potato or a stalk of broccoli or something else. You've got a little baby, a little member of the human family waiting to be born. So when I was an adolescent, I first heard about abortion, the idea that someone would kill that baby inside the womb. And it was very clear to me that that's what we were talking about. You could cover it up with all sorts of euphemisms. You could say terminating a pregnancy or removing the products of conception and all that stuff. But even as an adolescent, I could see through all that nonsense that that was simply rhetorically masking the reality of what was happening. And that was the taking of the life of an innocent child. My mother started going to pro-life meetings, meetings of our local pro-life group, the West Virginia Right to Life Group, which was in our hometown of Morgantown, and it met down at the one of the university chaplaincies for West Virginia University, which is in our town. And so I began to get involved then, and I remember probably at 13 or 14 years old sitting in the meetings listening, and there were two people in the meetings who were particularly impressive. It was a couple of young doctoral students in philosophy or graduate students in the advantage of philosophy at West Virginia University. And, of course, they could understand and explain the debate about abortion and why they had adopted the pro-life position very, very clearly. And I remember being so deeply impressed with that. And that was probably one of the things that led me on toward a career in philosophy. Jurisprudence simply means the philosophy of law, and that's what my background and training is in. And the seeds of that vocational choice are probably listening to those guys, those graduate students, in those meetings. But the meeting simply reinforced what I knew, that that what abortion was the taking of innocent human life. And so when Roe versus Wade was handed down in 1973, and I was 17 years old, I was shocked and I was appalled that the Supreme Court of the United States, which is supposed to be enforcing our constitutional guarantees of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness — those are, of course, contained in the Declaration, but those are the ideals animating the Constitution of the United States — I was appalled that the Supreme Court would license the wholesale killing of the unborn in this way. So I vowed right then that I was going to fight this. I was going to be part of the movement to try to restore our nation to a respect for the sanctity of human life in all stages and conditions, for the principle that every member of the human family, every living human being, no matter how small or poor or vulnerable or weak or dependent, every member of the human family is the bearer of a profound, inherent, and equal dignity. And now, many, many decades later, I'm still devoting myself to that cause.
And I want you to talk about this Supreme Court decision. Many people think that abortion was voted upon by the American public, and the American public decided that this would be a good policy for us to adopt going through the legislative process, and thus it became a law. But that isn't what happened at all. And why it matters, you wrote a great piece, which we've got linked at cradlemyheart.org, for First Things, about, you know, comparing this decision to the Dred Scott decision. What happens when the Supreme Court makes a decision versus a law being passed and enacted coming through the channels of Congress and all of the things that it takes for the will of the people to be expressed through law?
When the United States was established, when we separated from England after the successful War of Independence, the founders of our nation decided that they would constitute us as a republic, that we would not simply replicate the monarchy of Britain or create an oligarchy, a rule by a few, but we would create a republic that had a powerful democratic component. It wasn't a pure democracy, but a republic, a regime in which government is not only of the people, but for the people, and not only of and for the people, but by the people, as Lincoln would remind us years after the founding at Gettysburg. So the principle of the Constitution is that where a matter is not taken off the table by the Constitution for enforcement by the judiciary, the matter is to be resolved by democratic deliberation, by the principles of republican, the institutions of republican government. But unfortunately, at several key points in our national history, republican government has been, the principles of republican government have been grossly violated when the Supreme Court, acting completely without regard to the Constitution, acting anti-constitutionally, has intervened in a debate, in a public dispute, on an issue that is not covered by the Constitution, that the Constitution leaves for resolution by the democratic process. The first major case of that was in the mid-1850s, when the Supreme Court of the United States intervened in the debate about slavery to strike down, again, with no constitutional warrant, to strike down a law that would have banned slavery, a law enacted by the people's representatives in Congress that would have banned slavery in the federal territories, not in the states where slavery existed, because the Constitution did not authorize the Congress to ban slavery in states, but it did leave the Congress free to ban slavery in the federal territories. So when Congress did that, the Supreme Court intervened without constitutional warrant and overturned that, thus establishing slavery in the federal territories as legally protected, and even holding that black people, whether they are slave or free, even free black people, could not even be citizens of the United States and enjoy the rights of citizenship. Well, President Lincoln knew exactly what was going on. He knew that this decision, although handed down ostensibly in the name of the Constitution, was actually a gross violation of the Constitution. So President Lincoln, in his first inaugural address, informed the public that he would not accept this Dred Scott decision as a binding rule, but rather would treat it as an anti-constitutional aberration, that the decision would be enforced as to the parties of the case, but would not be treated as a general rule or a law that's binding on him and on the federal government. So he supported legislation that restored the ban on slavery in the federal territories, and in defiance of the justices, in defiance of the Dred Scott ruling, he treated free blacks as citizens. He handed them passports when they were requesting passports for foreign travel. He gave patents to black inventors, treating them as citizens, and so forth. Well, it happened again in 1973 in Roe v. Wade. And just as Dred Scott denied an entire class of citizens, black citizens, their fundamental human rights, Roe v. Wade denied the unborn children of our country, their most basic human rights, the basic human right to life. And like Dred Scott, it was not done by democratic processes, but rather by the Supreme Court intervening without any warrant in the text or logic or structure or original understanding of the Constitution to impose the justice's own personal moral and political views on the rest of the nation. So it should be treated and regarded as Lincoln treated and regarded the Dred Scott decision, in my opinion.
And so at a practical level, what does that mean? Does it mean we owe it a civil war? What does it mean to defy this? You know, I'm thinking about the Center for Medical Progress case, where an indictment now comes down on the whistleblowers for falsifying a federal document because they crafted fake IDs to start their shell company that exposed Planned Parenthood selling body parts. Their indictment also included them being guilty of a charge of being guilty of buying the fetal parts. And as they noted, you know, how are we guilty of buying if no one is selling, for one thing? But are you saying that, you know, acts like this to go forward and try to expose the wrongdoing of Planned Parenthood are appropriate and needed? Or is it something else that you're driving at when you're saying we ought to defy this in the same way that Lincoln defied Dred Scott?
We should support and our Congress should enact legislation protecting unborn children, such as the 20-week pain-capable bill Congress is deliberating about and I hope will enact into law. The current president, of course, would veto it, but I'm hoping that we will have as our next president a president who will sign that bill into law. Something similar happened back in the 1990s when President Clinton, to his eternal shame, vetoed the law protecting children from being aborted during birth, the partial birth abortion bill. But Congress came back when we got a new president. President Bush enacted the legislation again, and President Bush signed it into law, and so that horrific practice is now banned as a matter of federal law. We should do the same thing, keep moving incrementally, step by step, back to protect more and more and more unborn children from abortion. We should ban all funding for organizations that participate in the evil of abortion. The banning of funding for Planned Parenthood should be a no-brainer, and we should consider the refusal, any refusal by a presidential aspirant or candidate to bow to block the funding of Planned Parenthood, we should consider that as disqualifying for that candidate. I will certainly only consider supporting candidates who will vow to block all funding to Planned Parenthood and similar organizations that are involved in the mass killing of unborn children. So there are lots of things we can do. No one is proposing a civil war. Lincoln himself did not propose a civil war. He did propose legislation to protect unborn children. He did treat legislation to protect black people in the federal mm-hmm. territories. He did support an act on the proposition that blacks should be treated as citizens in defiance of Dred Scott against Sanford. And similarly, our president should treat unborn children as human beings deserving of protection in defiance of the Supreme Court's decision, treating them as if they are non-human creatures, property, meaningless blobs of tissue.
There's a proposal on the table from Hillary Clinton. I don't know if any other candidates are actually supporting it at this point, but to roll back the Hyde Amendment, which prevents federal funding of abortion services. Tell us about the importance of that idea.
Well, that's disgraceful of Hillary Clinton, but of course Hillary Clinton is waist deep in the blood of unborn children as a result of her long advocacy on behalf of the abortion lobby and the abortion industry, the abortion power. So I'm not surprised that Hillary Clinton not only wants abortion to be freely available, but wants to implicate all of her fellow citizens in the killings by forcing us to pay with our tax dollars for abortions. That absolutely needs to be resisted. Republicans should unite to protect the Hyde Amendment, which protects all of us from being forced against our consciences to participate in the killing of unborn children. And those remaining good pro-life Democrats should stand fast with us. There are still a few left. I wish we had a lot more. I myself began as a pro-life Democrat, so I have a lot of sympathy with the people who are still fighting the fight against the odds in the Democratic Party. But they should stand fast here and stand strong and join the Republicans to make sure that our consciences are protected and our fellow citizens and ourselves are not implicated in this horrific evil.
Robert George is our guest, and he's professor of jurisprudence at Princeton University and the author of several volumes, including Embryo. And I recommend it if you are looking for a great addition to your pro-life apologetics bookshelf. Professor George, you've written that we must love mother and child equally, limitlessly, and unconditionally, and never pit the alleged good of one against the other. You mentioned love in your opening remarks about, you know, your passion for the cause of life. And as I think about that, it strikes a note of hope. And I know that you have, although you've been, you know, soldiering on ever since Roe v. Wade became the law of the land due to this Roe versus Wade decision, you still hold out hope. Tell us about...
I'm filled with hope. I see brave and brilliant young men and women flooding into the pro-life movement. I don't know, Kim, if you've been to the annual march or you attend the annual march in Washington on January 22nd every year, the date that Roe versus Wade was handed down. Tens of thousands, sometimes hundreds of thousands of people are marching, and they are overwhelmingly young people. I see my own pro-life students coming out of Princeton. I also teach at Harvard. I know pro-life students who are up there. They're the bravest and in many cases the most brilliant students that we have. I know that some of your listeners will know the names of Sharif Girgis and Ryan Anderson, Melissa Moskella, Daniel Mark, all of whom are students of mine who are great leaders now in this and other very worthy causes, leading intellectuals in these movements. So this gives me a lot of hope. And it is, in the end, all about love. Now, we got to understand, love is not simply an emotion. It's not simply a feeling. Love is the active willing of the good of the other for the sake of the other. And when I say we must love both mother and child and never pit mother against child or child against mother, that's what I mean, actively willing the good of both mother and child. I've had the privilege throughout my years in the pro-life movement of not only working for legislative reform, not only working in the courtrooms, but also assisting with the wonderful work of the pro-life clinics from Sacramento, California, the Sacramento Life Center, to the Several Sources clinics in my home state now of New Jersey. I've had the privilege of working with them to bring comfort and care and assistance, material as well as moral and spiritual help, to women who are in need and often find themselves in desperate situations where they're being pressured to have abortions, or just the pressure of their circumstances is tempting them to take the lives of their unborn children. But I've seen people in the clinics, and it's mostly women. I find myself mostly working alongside women in those clinics, some of whom themselves are post-abortive women, deeply regret the abortions that that they had. Often women who've had abortions having been told that it was simply removing a clump of tissue, having been lied to about abortion. But I find myself working with these wonderful women who are caring for their sisters, and not only while the baby is on the way, but even after the baby is born, you know, helping with material needs, helping to take care of the baby so mom can get back to work or back to school. These are the great heroes of the pro-life movement, and I'm just inspired by them, and they, too, fill me with hope. Our movement has got to be a movement that's working in every dimension of this problem, in the legislative halls, in the courtrooms, on the streets with our protests and demonstrations, but also in the clinics, helping women, our sisters who are deeply in need and sometimes very desperate. All of that work has to be done, and all of us are called to be part of it.
You know, you've written about also, Professor George, I want to close on this note because I think this is what strikes a bit of despair in the hearts of those who would like to see abortion be unthinkable. That there's a role of the religious community, the Religious Coalition for Abortion Rights, was there at the very beginning, lending credence to some sort of spiritual, assent to this license to abort. Maybe give us your thoughts about, if nothing else, a prayer direction, or how best to persuade hearts and minds within the church who are not yet, you know, understanding of the value of each life.
Well, what I perceive is that the whole idea of trying to find a religious justification for abortion is just collapsing. This movement, the so-called Religious Coalition for Abortion Rights, this movement was really a fraud. I think I'm just going to be very candid with you, a fraud from the beginning. These people knew perfectly well what was going on in abortion, taking innocent human life. They knew that it was in violation of the Fifth Commandment, thou shalt not kill. And yet they tried to put an overlay of spiritual approval on it. But unfortunately for them, but fortunately for the unborn babies of the world, since the foundation of that movement, since that movement was created, all the science has come out against them. All the science confirms what they wanted to deny, that from the earliest stage, from the earliest embryonic stage, you have from a biological point of view, a whole living member of the species Homo sapiens, a living human being. The little creature, you or me, that begins as an embryo, develops himself or herself, for sex is determined in the human from the very beginning, from the embryonic into and through the fetal, infant, child, and adolescent stages, and ultimately into adulthood with its determinateness and unity and identity fully intact. And that process, from the earliest embryonic stage into adulthood, is not directed by some outside force. It's directed internally. So what you do have is a living member of the human species, someone who is entitled to the protection of that commandment, thou shalt not kill. Kim, I want to say one more thing, and it goes back to a point that you made a moment ago. The pro-life movement must be and is all about forgiveness, mercy, hope, love, care, and healing. There's nothing punitive about this. I don't want to see anybody punished. I don't want to see women punished. I want to see women healed. I want to see consciences seared. I want to see people develop the love for mother and child alike that we're all called to have in our hearts. When we're dealing with tragic situations, when we're dealing with difficult situations, women who are under pressure, women who are desperate. It's got to be all about love. And if women do the wrong thing, it's got to be all about mercy and forgiveness and helping them to see that this does not have to haunt them for the rest of their lives, as it has for many, many women, that they can seek mercy and forgiveness from God, and that they can heal, and that they can become forces that help other women from help them to avoid the same sort of heartache and heartbreak.
Mm. Your passion turned it into a prayer and a beautiful note for us to end on, because we are out of time. Thank you so much for being our guest.
My pleasure, Kim.
Professor Robert P. George of Princeton University. You can learn more about his mission at cradlemyheart.org. Now, stay with us. Coming up on Faith Radio, we'll open up the phone for your calls at 1-800-811-3003 here at Cradle My Heart Radio.
Safe place to connect with others, finding God's love after abortion. This is Cradle My Heart Radio.
This is where the healing begins. Oh, this is where the healing starts. When you come to where you're broken again, the light meets the dark. The light meets the dark.
Cradle My Heart with Kim Cotola. Join the conversation. Call toll-free 800-811-3003. 800-811-3003.
Good evening, and thank you for being with us tonight. Thanks so much for making Cradle My Heart Radio your choice of a Sunday evening for this live portion of the broadcast. And if you were inspired and riled up and excited to hear the message of Robert George, I really share that emotion. He is such an impressive speaker and has done so much for the cause for life and continues to do so. And if you enjoyed his message, or maybe you were challenged by it, you have questions, the phones are open right now. 1-800-811-3003 is our number here at Cradle My Heart Radio. And we are live here for you. 1-800-811-3003. So much to talk about on the life issue in the news this week. Of course, with the passing of Antonin Scalia, what does this mean for the cases in front that are already on the docket at the Supreme Court? And one of them, of course, this case involving Texas's law restricting abortion rights in that state back in 2013. When Texas ruled that admitting privileges were needed for doctors or practitioners performing abortions, when they ruled that abortion facilities had to be as safe as ambulatory surgical centers, and put in a few other restrictions, including no abortions after 20 weeks when the fetus can feel pain, according to the evidence that was presented to the Texas legislature. The abortion industry shrunk measurably in Texas. 44 facilities, I believe, closed down in 2013. A judge then ruled that that produced an undue burden on access to abortion for the women in the state, but the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals upheld the law. So it went to the Supreme Court, and it's to be heard, next month. What could happen with the passing of Justice Scalia is the court could split, which would leave things exactly as they are, and with the Fifth Circuit ruling being the precedent. And then those restrictions would also be constitutional in Louisiana and Mississippi. But some are saying that the timing of Scalia's passing is extremely unfortunate for the pro-life cause, because many believed that he was going to use this case in Texas as a means of ruling against Roe versus Wade, which he had always said was not the will of the people. And he tried at other junctures to roll that law back. The Webster case, Sandra Day O'Connor, did not go along with his decision, and he said we can expect to see more cartloads full of mail arriving and more protests on the street because this ruling, this Roe versus Wade ruling, does not reflect the legislative process or the will of the American people. And it is the Supreme Court which has divided over the issue. So there's a lot to know about that, and I doubt that anything in terms of whether President Obama makes a nomination, it certainly wouldn't be heard and confirmed, et cetera, and a judge seated, a justice seated, before this comes up on the docket. And it could be reheard. That has happened in cases, but it'll be very interesting to see what happens in Texas as a result of the passing of Justice Scalia. We can talk about that if you'd like. 1-800-811-3003. I should mention we have a great prize tonight for anyone who calls, because we have some quantities of this book. It's A Case for Life, The Case for Life by Scott Klusendorf, Equipping Christians to Engage the Culture. And this is one of the central texts that we're using in our program for the Certificate in Applied Bioethics at Oklahoma Wesleyan University. I attended the first 6 credits of the program last summer and will be, Lord willing, completing the certificate coming up this summer in July. And this book is such a wealth of information because it brings together the case from logic, medically, and philosophically, making the case for life. And yes, Scott Klusendorf is Christian, and yes, it can be argued, of course, theologically as well, but you don't need the Bible to make the case for life. And this is important because a lot of people will reject a biblical argument out of hand. So we need to be able to meet those folks at their level. And The Case for Life is a brilliant way to equip you to do that. One of the things, at 1-800-811-3003, join us if you'd like a copy. Just all you have to do is say hello on the air and we'll send one out to you. 1-800-811-3003. And as always, you need not give your name. We will take your name off the air so we know where to mail the book, but you don't have to identify yourself on the air. You can be anonymous or use an alias. That's entirely up to you. So this book, The Case for Life, lays out the fact, and once you know how to do this, once you know how to see this in the arguments of others or the assertions of others, you'll be able to help them think better about the life issue. And Klusendorf begins from the premise that the abortion controversy is not a debate between those who are pro-choice and those who are anti-choice. It is not about privacy. It's not about trusting women to decide. It's not about forcing morality. It's about one question. And that question, the issue at the center of abortion, is what is the unborn human being? And there's the answer. The unborn are assumed to not be members of the human community by those who argue for abortion rights. Most every objection that you will hear by someone who is saying that abortion should be legal, and now these days one of the more prominent views is that it should be legal under any and all circumstances, is all of the objections assume the unborn aren't human beings. When you start talking about poverty, when you start talking about women's rights, when you start talking about rape, when you start talking about fetal deformity, when you start talking about all of the justifications that people will use to say that abortion needs to be legal, we can always bring them back to the question, what is the unborn? So instead of proving the conclusion with facts and arguments that the unborn are not human, they assume it in the course of their rhetoric. And logically, that's called begging the question. You'll hear that phrase misused a lot. People say that someone's begging the question when they just mean it's leading to a question. But begging the question is to argue something from an assumption that you have not offered evidence for. You're just making an assumption. And they're not offering any evidence generally to prove that the unborn are not human, because such evidence does not exist. In embryology, in the science of the development of human life, there is no question that from conception forward, there is a distinct, living, and whole human being. And this is one of the facts that you'll be able to have at your fingertips as you read and absorb The Case for Life by Scott Klusendorf. We have some copies of it for our listeners tonight at 1-800-811-3003, 1-800-811-3003. And here's why this matters. There was a story this week on lifenews.com about U.S. Representative Gwen Moore from Wisconsin. And she's very upset that her pro-life colleagues asked her and other African-American leaders why they're not standing up for the unborn black babies who are often aborted. So she wrote a column for the Washington Post criticizing pro-life legislators for using the Black Lives Matter phrase to call for protection of unborn babies targeted by the abortion industry. She entitled her, or she began her column by writing, "Dear conservatives, abortion clinics don't target the black community." And so she went on to say, "The inability or outright refusal to recognize the barriers that black women encounter in accessing quality prevention services and reproductive care walks the line between sheer blindness and malice." And this is Congresswoman Gwen Moore, Wisconsin. She says, "Black Lives Matter is a critical component to our shared struggle for reproductive rights. It extends far beyond the realm of deadly interactions with police and economic inequality," which is, of course, the central message of Black Lives Matter. Moore says, "It's a means to amplify our voices against injustice and to empower our communities, and it provides an opportunity for those to shape a future worthy of their highest aspirations, free of political paternalism and discrimination. The social justice movement means something to us." Well, she went on to say that the goal of those who would protect unborn black life is to intimidate and inflict trauma while limiting the health care choices for pregnant women in need. She wrote, "No one denies that the abortion rate in black communities is higher than in white communities, but failing to mention the underlying context behind those numbers demonstrate a disturbing lack of awareness of the impact of poverty and the realities faced by black women in America." But you see, what she's doing there is saying abortion doesn't matter because, why? She's assuming the unborn are not human. She cited a study that found the lack of economic security as one of the primary reasons why many women said they sought or had abortions. But of course, you and I would never accept that, nor would any sitting member of Congress put it forward as a reason if we were talking about eliminating toddlers. If we were talking about whether or not it ought to be legal for women to kill their two-year-olds when economic circumstances press in, if economic security was a reason that we could use to kill one another, none of us would be safe. She doesn't follow her own conclusion to its end, Life News concluded. They said pro-lifers readily agree. Poverty is a reason why many women have abortions. But economic instability is a major factor and one of the reasons why pro-lifers run pregnancy centers. So, I mean, it's a non-problem on a very important level. Micaiah Bilger is writing for LifeNews.com, and I agree. But more importantly is the fact that Congresswoman Moore has made an assumption. She has not said science shows these unborn are not human beings, therefore we are free to kill them. She's not said any such thing. She's merely assuming that they are not human. And when you can begin to see the logical problem with this, it becomes that much easier to stand in truth and to really stand for life as you make the case for life. So we'd love to get a copy of this book in your hand and equip you to 1-800-811-3003 is our number. And we'll take a break for you to get to the phones and give us a call here at Cradle My Heart Radio.
A safe place to connect with others. Finding God's love after abortion. Cradle My Heart Radio with Kim Cattola. Call toll free at 800-811-3003. seeking to help others find God's love after abortion. Cradle My Heart Radio with Kim Cattola. Call toll free at 800-811-3003.
Copy of The Case for Life for our callers tonight, 1-800-811-3003. Please join us. We'd love to hear your thoughts about the life story in the news. Maybe you've heard some good reporting on the meaning for the reproductive rights issue at the Supreme Court level with the passing of Justice Scalia. Maybe you want to comment on Congresswoman Moore and the Black Lives Matter issue. We've covered that issue of blacks being targeted by the abortion industry, how they are 13% of the population, but 37% of those who abort. And in places like New York City, there are more black babies now aborted than are born. There's no dispute that this is happening. And what needs to happen is for all of us to have our eyes opened to the humanity of all of the unborn so that we can give them the dignity that they need and find solutions that don't involve eliminating a segment of the population to relieve the suffering and problems of others. 1-800-811-3003. Let's go to the phones and say hi to Tom. Welcome to Cradle My Heart Radio. How are you tonight?
Oh, real good, real good. And I'm calling from a state that is very, very pro-life. Very thankful my wife and I moved from Minnesota to North Dakota for many reasons, but this is one of the reasons. And I'm sure you're familiar with North Dakota going all the way also to the Supreme Court, trying to shut down the last abortion clinic. There's only one in the state. It's in Fargo, North Dakota. It went to a vote with a general election, and about 80% of the people were against abortion in this state. And it got very restrictive, but then a few people took North Dakota to court, and the judge struck down that they had to provide. There's more to this, but even the attorney general at this time, he tried and tried. They really tried to reverse this decision. So North Dakota is very pro-life. There's many pro-life states, Texas. I think this is a very prayerful moment to pray in the right justice, the next justice.
Mm-hmm. I couldn't agree with you more, Tom, and I thank you for putting it that way. And thank you for the update from North Dakota. Some people are not familiar with that recent history. That was, 3 years ago that North Dakota passed the law?
Right, but then it was just ruled on last summer around mm-hmm. the same time as the marriage amendment, and yep. That it was struck down at the, yeah. So, now that same attorney general is now running for our governor in North Dakota.
So, yes, well, we will pray. And thank you so much. Hold on and be sure and give us your address so we can get a copy of The Case for Life to you. Appreciate you listening, Tom. We also have an anonymous caller tonight. Welcome to Cradle My Heart Radio.
Hi.
Hi. Thanks for checking in. How are you tonight?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm doing well. I'm happy to get a copy of The Case for Life to you. Tell me about your interest in the book. Had you heard of it before?
No, I hadn't. I'm just wanting to have a little more information. The church that I go to prefers to remain neutral on the topic, I work with the youth quite a bit, and just kind of want to make sure that I am well informed, and just need to kind of figure out how I can stand up for what I believe in without contradicting or doing anything that would not be appropriate in my role at the church.
Sure.
I'm
well,
not,
wonderful.
I'm not on the staff at all. I'm just a teacher with the youth.
Sure. I think this will be a great resource for you. And hold on, and we'll get the address where we can send you a copy of The Case for Life, okay?
Okay. Thank you very much.
Appreciate you listening. Thanks for checking in tonight. This is a beautiful passage from this book, our resource tonight. And this is Scott Klusendorf quoting Greg Kokel. And it says, the story is told of a king who, having discovered a theft in the royal treasury, decrees that the criminal be publicly flogged for this affront to the crown. When soldiers haul the thief before the king as he sits in his judgment seat, there in chains stands the frail form of the king's own mother. Without flinching, he orders the old woman to be bound to the whipping post in front of him. And when she's secured, he stands up, lays down his imperial scepter, sets aside his jeweled crown, removes his royal robes, and enfolds the tiny old woman with his own body. Bearing his back to the whip, he orders that the punishment commence. Every blow meant for the criminal lands with full force upon the bare back of the king until the last lash falls. In like manner, in those dark hours, the Father wrapped us in his Son, who shields us, taking the justice we deserve. This is not an accident. It was planned. The prophet Isaiah described it 700 years earlier. Surely grief himself, our griefs, he himself bore. He was pierced through for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The chastening for our well-being fell upon him, and by his scourging we are healed. All of us like sheep have gone astray. Each of us has turned to his own way, but the Lord has caused the iniquity of us all to fall on him. And this is Scott Klusendorf's way of conveying the grace and mercy of Jesus Christ toward those who have had an abortion, and the gospel truth of the forgiveness of God, which is complete for us in Jesus Christ. And so, this is why, for me, this is such a beautiful pro-life resource, because the hope for post-abortion for men and women is that, you know, if you've had an abortion, as Scott Klusendorf puts it, you don't need an excuse. You need an exchange. The righteousness of God for your sinfulness, which we have in Jesus Christ. And so it's our joy and our pleasure to get a copy of this book into your hands. And we still have a couple of minutes if you have time to get to the phone at 1-800-811-3003. I wish everyone could read it. And I will give you a shameless plug here, too, that I will come for your organization and present The Case for Life in a 1 or 2 hour workshop, because that's what we're being trained to do. Especially the vision is to speak to the youth, whether at high school level or at the college level, and Christian high schools and colleges. So I am available for that. And you can just send me an email, and we have a contact form at cradlemyheart.org, and would be very happy to talk with you about how we would work that out. Because, this is something that is not, as our last caller said, so many churches remain, as she put it, neutral. But what does neutral mean in a place where abortion is legal? It means, as someone once said, that the abortion clinics are operating at the church's consent. That sounds harsh, but isn't it true? If we remain neutral when our nation says there's no moral reason not to do this, what really is the church doing but going along with something that's evil and that is so clearly prohibited from God's word in the commandment against the shedding of innocent blood? And Klusendorf is very careful to talk about that, too, in The Case for Life, that is the way to make the case biblically. You know, you don't need to make the case biblically. You can make the case from science and philosophy, but if someone will argue that the Bible is silent, or some of the other things that you may hear as you're talking about pro-life apologetics with people, the answer is the Bible is very clear that we may not shed innocent blood. And there's no yet method of abortion devised that can be completed without shedding the blood of the unborn. thank you so much for being a part of the broadcast tonight. We really appreciate that. Get in touch with us off the air if you are not able to call in. Go to cradlemyheart.org is the very best way to do that, especially if you want to send an email. And my email address is simply kim@kimketola.com, but it's easier maybe to find cradlemyheart.org than spelling out the last name for you, K-E-T-O-L-A. We're on Facebook. We're on Twitter. You will find the links to our social media there at cradlemyheart.org. I hope you can join us next week. We have a guest who's going to talk about how we as Christians can unite over the issue of abortion. And that's a vision that I hope all of us will catch, because if we can do that, how much greater will our chances be for influencing the culture around us? So be sure and join us every week. And also coming up in the very near future, we're going to have Frances Beckwith of Defending Life, one of the best books that you can read to learn about how to defend the case for life. Kim Ketola, thanking you so much for being with us tonight. Join us at cradlemyheart.org. We'll be here next week. And remember, Jesus loves you, and so do we.